Hello everyone, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with a leadership and management theme. I am Rod Jones, content manager at the Institute, and in this podcast we will be looking at news items up to 18th of September 2019. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Our first story, Kate, asks, what should leaders learn from the Valuable 500 Disability Campaign? This is the campaign launched at Davos earlier this year that aims to persuade 500 CEOs around the world to put inclusion of the disabled at the heart of their board agendas. Importantly, the campaign is holding its signatories accountable for their progress, and signatories now include the Big Four accounting firms of KPMG, Deloitte, PricewaterhouseCoopers, and Ernst & Young. Valuable 500 founder, disability activist and social entrepreneur Caroline Casey said that the Big Four professional services firm have the national power to make a difference in their sector, and it is fantastic to see global competitors come together to collaborate and solve global inclusion issues. Kate, what should leaders take away from the Big Four's move to collaborate on providing boost for the Valuable 500's message?
Sometimes I'm a bit sceptical about these sorts of initiatives because of the sheer PR potential of all these big companies getting together and signing documents to say that they passionately believe in inclusion. They say here they're going to be held accountable. That to me is much more interesting. Down the line, what have they achieved? What is their starting point? What are the sorts of things that they're going to do? And how are they going to know they've really made a difference? So it's the reporting on the actions rather than the intentions that I think is a much more powerful signal.
Okay, thank you very much, Kate. And our next story actually looks at this in a little bit more depth and considers the dangers of mistaking diversity for inclusion in the workplace. Forbes contributor Dana Brownlee suggests that too many companies make the mistake of assuming that diversity and inclusion are synonymous, or that one automatically implies the other. And she argues that this mistake is a risky one. She suggests, for example, that diversity without inclusion may be perceived as tokenism, and that individuals from underrepresented communities placed in positions of senior leadership may have a position of leadership, but realise that they may still not wield the same influence as their majority counterparts. Furthermore, organisations may invite underrepresented groups to participate on a board or leadership team, and once those new invites realise they're only tokens, they abruptly leave, oftentimes with more disgust and frustration than they had previously. Kate, do you agree with Dana Brownlee's conclusion that if diversity is a sprint, inclusion is a marathon? Each requires different training, conditioning, and commitment.
I do. I think they're very different. And I think Dana's right that people do tend to use them almost interchangeably. Diversity is having difference present in the organisation and you can measure it. But if those underrepresented groups are disproportionately represented at low levels or in non-strategic areas, or however they're not as mainstream as the more represented groups, then they're not included. So that's not inclusion. That's just being aware that you need to have a bit of difference around the place and you're able to count it. I'd almost suggest that if an environment is an inclusive one, then you're not really thinking about diversity anymore. You're just thinking about individuals who are making a contribution to the organisation achieving its goals. And I think it's when we stop talking about diversity but celebrate really inclusive workplaces, we won't even be thinking about tokenism. And I think this is a word that I find so difficult because it's so easy to level it. Anybody who's from an underrepresented group who gets a position and is then open to criticism because they only got the job because of their particular status or they're so much under the spotlight, where those people from well-represented groups, they're not subject to that sort of criticism and never feel for a moment that they're a token. So well done, Dana, for really challenging some of the language and the practices around diversity and inclusion.
Thank you, Kate. Our next question looks at the ethics of second sources of income, so-called side hustles. In its 9th September publication, the Modern Life Report, compiled from a survey of more than 2,000 adults, Fidelity International reveals that almost half of people in their 20s have a second source of income, compared to just 21% in their 50s. The figures suggest that workers are increasingly expected the latitude to perform side hustles in parallel with their primary occupations. Quoted in the research, Dr. Charmi Patel said, "A formal policy on side hustling within employment contracts will become essential. A key issue is compliance. If staff are working flexible hours, from home or virtually, the control might not be there on whether they are conducting their own business on company time and using company property and resources to do so." Kate, from the perspectives of both well-being and employees' expectations of how much access they should have to their staff, what are the soundest ethical conditions in which employees can run side hustles?
Well, my first impression on hearing about this is what a shame that Dr. Patel immediately looks at the downside that these people are not to be trusted and that their side hustle is somehow stealing from their main job. It's interesting, again, with the age, it could be that the younger people are not earning enough, and we hear a lot about millennials being unable to make ends meet, but it's also indicative of that blurring between work and leisure that flexible working encourages or allows, and that some people might be doing what we're calling a side hustle, and it might be something that they're passionate and they really like. So it could be singing in a band or being a DJ or whatever, baking cakes, whatever it is they do, they love it. And then it's really a paid leisure activity. But you would only know these as a manager if you're interested in what your staff are doing and you're asking them how they spend their leisure time. You know what they're great at, you know what they enjoy doing, and that's when you can start worrying about whether it's adversely affecting their performance. Take the necessary steps then to talk to them if it's a financial thing. And this, again, where flexible working can really help. It might suit some people with important side hustles to do 4-day weeks. How can you help support them in order to make sure that they're fulfilled, both their main employment, but also outside that main employment?
Thank you, Kate. Our next story looks at a press release from Blue Sky PR that suggests half of us do not fulfil our potential because we're scared of making mistakes. According to new research from Niner Road Business University and IE University, one out of two people think they could perform better if they were not worrying about making mistakes. The researchers studied 1,000 people and found that more than 40% of them say they are worried about making mistakes between 20 to 40% of the time or more. Professor Nick Van Dam states that a lack of self-confidence can have a negative impact on learning ability, work performance, and career success, and that it is important that companies start responding to this crisis of confidence now in the interests of long-term employability. Kate, what can leaders do to address this apparent lack of self-confidence in the workplace?
Obviously, we've just got a brief description of the research here, but I can't really see the connection between making mistakes and self-confidence. In many jobs, you probably should be worried about making mistakes, and that's indicative of high standards of professionalism, and that you can also be reassured that you're able to correct things when they go wrong and there'll be an understanding and you'll get support, because don't we all learn so much from getting things wrong? So the anxiety about making mistakes might be more to do with the consequences or how those mistakes are received in the workplace than a lack of self-confidence. Because to me, there's something a bit worrying about somebody being so self-confident that they don't care about making mistakes, when actually it might be critical for the work that they're doing that they minimise the mistakes. So as I said, maybe we haven't got the full picture here. But let's not overly criticize people for making mistakes, and let's think about self-confidence when you genuinely should believe you're good at something because you are, and that is supported by your colleagues and by your manager.
Okay, thank you, Kate. And listeners may be interested to know that confidence was the topic of this week's webinar and was called The Laws of Confidence, Confident People Are Made, Not Born, by Nisha Panchal. And one of the questions was, how do you manage staff who are overconfident to the detriment of their own performance and others around them? Listeners can find further topical content on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insight on those stories.
Thank you, Rod.